There we go. Now we're recording. All right. Guys, the banner says episode 11. It's actually only episode 10. We're one ahead because we missed spring break week, but the audience will never see that. That's just for you guys. Our guests tonight, a couple of professional wargamers as we're leading into Connections Online. We thought we'd bring a couple of the pros on here to help talk about some of that crossover between the hobby and the pro world. And so Kevin is here. Kevin's just recently launched Near Peer Simulations and is heavily involved with the Fight Club folks online in helping develop some of those reps and sets for the professionals to get in sort of a semi-formal wargaming context, I guess the best way to put it there, Kevin.
Yeah, it's basically a safe environment for military professionals and civilians who may not have military experience to basically coexist and fight each other in war games without being afraid to lose because of some unit reputation or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's cool. And a couple of the Dragoons have wandered over into some Fight Club events. And I know Peter's gotten very heavily involved with Fight Club after we pointed him in your guys' direction. You know, been keeping an eye on the Fight Club stuff for several years now. Also joining us, Mitch Reed, who everybody knows because the dude's been running a wargaming blog for what, 8 years now?
It seems like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's that and our podcast. And when people say, oh, I listen to your podcast, I said, you're the guy then. So, yeah.
I think we may have the same guy because our distro is probably about you're probably a little ahead of us just because I don't think you rebooted your podcast in the middle of it all when you changed websites because you've owned yours all along. So,
yeah, something like that, I guess. But, you know, for the three guys that listen and they're all related to me, I do appreciate it. But I do listen to yours. I listen to yours when I paint, believe it or not. So,
oh, well, cool. I guess. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, well,
I hope we don't shock you into some bad paint jobs then. So,
No. I need no help with that.
Yeah. So Mitch and Kevin both work in the professional wargaming space as well as being hobby wargamers. I will throw the blanket disclaimer out for you guys that y'all are not here as official reps of anything remotely related to the government. You're not speaking for them and they don't speak for you. And these are all your own opinions and not part of your official job or anything like that. Is that enough of a blanket statement to cover it all?
It is. You know, the key thing is I don't have any original thoughts, so.
Fair enough. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, with the original point of Connections back when Matt started all this thing back in the 90s was to try and, you know, bridge the gaps between the hobby and professional wargaming folks. Of course, the 90s were a lousy time to try and drag the hobby wargamers into anything because it all evaporated. But over the years, it has waxed and waned with the level of involvement of the hobbyists in what's primarily been a professionally focused conference kind of convention a little bit. Now the Connections brand is really expanded and it's gone just beyond what's now known as Connections US. And there's Connections UK, Connections North, Connections Oz. There's a bunch of different ones. And the Dragoons have been co-sponsoring Connections Online. This is our fourth one now. So rather than just bring on some hobby guys or just bring on some pro guys, we brought on a couple of guys that do both. And so, Mitch, as you look back on the several different wargaming jobs that you've had in the professional realm, as well as your life as a hobby wargamer, yep, is there one particular experience or facet or kind of pattern that you've seen that's really helped you out in the professional capacity that you brought with you from the wargaming, the hobby wargaming side?
You know, so... last year, to support Kevin's Circle DC, I gave a bunch of wargamers a tour of the Pentagon, wargame designers. And it was like Tim Desnahan, Maurice Suckling, and a couple of others. And about 2 hours into the tour, they go, well, you must laugh at our games. And I go, no, in fact, I steal from each and every one of you. Because when you guys abstract something right, you often don't know that. And that helps us out. And, you know, especially in analytical wargame where, hey, war's hard. So I steal a lot from them. I can't think of any one designer I do other than I had to write a competition game that the Air Force ran in 2020. And people were like, oh, this is very interesting mechanic here. It seems familiar. I go, yeah, because it's in Twilight Struggle. So but I asked Jason, I told him I was stealing it from him. And I paid him back because he came over to MCU to watch him play one of their war games that they run for the school. And they gave him a like 12 by 8 map.
Oh, wow.
from Twilight Struggle. What was funny is getting it into my car at the end of the day. So
yeah, gotta put the back seat down and run it through the trunk. So
yeah,
using Tim as an example, though, is a little bit of cheating since the guy is a National Guard officer and has been for a bunch of years. So
Tim Desnahan,
Tim Densham from
Densham Games. You know, I'll tell you what. He seems like a great guy, but didn't ask too many questions, and I didn't know he was in the military. But yeah. Then again, I wasn't either. I was in the Air Force. So
yeah, well.
There you go. I deployed a lot. The other day, somebody said chair force. I go, does your chair go Mach 2? No. Then go after yourself. Yeah, it was a great thing. But I think a lot of, from talking to a lot of game designers, they don't realize that a bunch of us, like Kevin and I, are diehard junkie gamers. And, yeah. You know, the video's not going to be going out, right?
No, but like, we're audio only.
Yeah, I mean, this is just part of the collection. I got a home room full of minis. And there's something I try to take from every game. And even if it's a bad game, there's something to be taken from it. I think there's a lot to learn. And, I've enjoyed doing both.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Kevin, looking at your time with the hobby war game side, and then bouncing that against what you're doing for your day job now, is there something in particular that sticks out from the hobby side that has been of particular use or resonance for you in the day job?
So I think I'm along the same lines as Mitch in the sense that there isn't really any specific thing that I can point to. I would say that I think my path is a little bit different, coming from basically just being a video gamer first, playing grand strategy games, and not really getting into the tabletop wargaming side until actually further down in the professional career. So a lot of the things that I would take are things that I may have done with a group of friends on a weekend, you know, setting up our own miniature war game exercise just for fun. And, you know, just basically having years of doing that for fun, seeing what keeps people engaged translates to keeping students engaged, or seeing what keeps a game short and can be done within 4 hours versus a 3-day event that loses interest. I think it's a lot of the nuanced person-to-person dynamics that go into professional military education, not necessarily designing like a key mechanic. So I think it's a little bit different, but kind of the same thing. I take from a bunch of different experiences.
I think there's a lot. So first of all, you know, tabletop versus digital has no distinction for us here at the Dragoons. We've got a ton of folks that do both. And so we're just as happy to throw down over a digital game as we are a tabletop one. We're the guys that are streaming live games 3 nights a week on YouTube with Tabletop Simulator. So we've got no problem.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah, Ozarski and those marathon games that he runs on some occasions, that they did manage to get Leipzig down to a mere 8 weeks instead of like the 13 it originally took them.
Which nice. Which Leipzig game?
They were doing, I think they were using the Blücher rules. They were doing minis within Tabletop Simulator, and in the original session they played back in 2019, so pre-pandemic they were doing this. Ended up taking them 13 or 14. Once you added up the number of hours that it took them to play the game with all of the different sessions, it lasted longer than the actual battle.
Was it as bloody?
Impressive.
Probably.
Yeah.
And when they decided to rerun it and do it again, they got it down to about 8 sessions.
I wish I could do that.
Yeah. Well, Saturday night fights, man. Hop in with them someday.
But
it just means you've got to give up like a month of Saturdays.
Yeah. 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 Well, it's not like I do anything all that great. You know, it's interesting. So one of the folks, one of our analysts next. So, Kevin, I hate to invite you here, but, you know, when we look at teaching our folks how to create games, one of the best things that we do is actually have them play games. So right now in my office for this Friday, I'm going to teach people Afghanistan 85, Mark Walker's great game. A bunch of idiots play tested it though. So that's all I could say. But next Friday, and Kevin, please come by at 3:00. We have a bar in our building that's totally unclassified, and we're doing Frank Chadwick's Third World War. One of the analysts is actually taking folks through this, because one of the interesting things that you'll maybe this will surprise you there is that Kevin and I are very unusual within our field. Actually, Kevin works for a fellow war gamer, but with me, I'm probably one third of my team hobby war games, and I've been trying to change that. So having them next Friday play yet another game, and I don't know if you guys have played Chadwick's, I'm pointing at it so people out there can see what I'm pointing at. That you know, all right, so I got the game, it's a classic, I'm never going to punch it because I never really enjoyed it back in the day, but I think it's a good way to teach our designers, developers, and analysts kind of how to look at games. Because one thing, and Kevin and I kind of have this together, I mean, Kevin has students play games, they're not necessarily gamers, and I, you know, looking at my team, oh, look, you have the original.
I got the original one and the new one.
Yeah. And
I like that box art.
Yeah, that was an iconic box art. It was, that's the old GDW version.
I don't have all four of the original series. I've just got the first one of the original series. I had several of them and they were lost in the great PCS purge of the mid-90s when I was moving from one station to another.
Yeah, it happened to all of us. But, you know, playing games like that, trying to teach people games and what games bring and different ways to look at mechanics. You know, somebody once asked, how can I get into professional war gaming? And I'm like, play a lot of games.
Yeah.
Or I get asked a lot, how do I design a game? I go, play a lot of games. It's really kind of that simple. And either you have it or you don't. But, you know, it's no matter what, it's a fun journey.
Yeah. Yeah. Worst case, you get to play a lot of games. So
you get to play. And then, you know, you could play a game like this. This is a game that we actually have a lot of folks play. And I don't know if you could see it here, but it's a kid's game. Nobody can see it. It's you roll a die. It's 1, 2, 3. And you have to hit the plunger on the toilet. And when it has too much, the poop flies out and kids have to catch it. And I got this for my son for his birthday. But it's when he turned 16, he did not enjoy it. So, but it's a good game. It's fun.
Yeah. I think, you know, you mentioned the comment about like, how do you get into the professional wargaming field? And I think that's something that's been a source of much discussion at Connections conferences, at least the 15 or so years that I've been involved in them. And from hearing folks talk about it at least 20 years before that, I mean, there's no straight glide path. Most of the folks that end up in it do so accidentally. And it's only been within about the last 5 to 10 years that people have sort of intentionally, you know, sought out and, you know, created or found these sorts of intentional professional wargaming positions.
Yeah, I mean, that's
the beneficiary of one of those.
Yeah. And you know, that's the kind of interesting thing. And I think Kevin has an interesting story of how he came upon it more so.
Yeah, I'm very passionate about it. And not to say, like, you know, be dramatic or any pity thing, but this job actually saved my life. The COVID pandemic, I lost everything. I was sleeping in a car, had a buddy offer me a couch in a room. And then I had a friend show me a job application. It was like, hey, you should apply for this. And it was for a war game SME. And I'm like, well, they're looking for somebody more qualified or somebody with a degree or somebody was like a colonel before. You know, not somebody like me who's just a gamer with maybe a more creative mind than the average gamer. And so I applied, I got the job. And then as soon as I started doing what was required in the job, I very quickly realized that it's all things that I was just doing for fun anyways in my free time. And there are about 20 other people I know that could easily do the job or could do it even better.
You know, one of the things, like, Kevin runs games for students, and I'm having gone to War College and Command General Staff, I couldn't do what he does because I'd be in jail for homicide. I know his boss pretty well, and just talking to people there that have played events that he's run, he actually is really good at it. So, I mean, it's an amazing story how he got his job now, but he's good at it. And I think the passion and the interest and a lot of the self-study. I was for the service I am working for now, I was never in it. Like I said, I wasn't in the military. I was in the Air Force. But, you know, it's, well, how do you know all these terms and how they fight? Because I study, because I understand a lot of this.
I can read.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And he actually, from what I hear now, I have a no poach clause though, with his, you know, the guys across the road. So, you know, you're going to have to piss those folks over there off. But, you know, he's actually really good at it because I do not have the patience for what he does.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think at a certain point, like working in that professional space, because I've done it some too, although it's, you know, almost 10 years gone at this point, it's sort of equal parts, you know, being a game master as well as a game designer, but also there's a significant amount of sort of teaching 100 level undergrad intro course for folks that have no real context to understand the material you're putting in front of them. From a game perspective, the contents of the game, the topic of the game is usually pretty well known to them, but the idea of the game mechanics that you're layering on top of it, usually that's just a total foreign language to a lot of these folks. Which is unfortunate. It'd be nice if wargaming were more widespread in the military, that you would spend less time explaining what wargaming is. But
and that is why I'm such a huge fan of what Kevin does, and guys like Dave over at down in Maxwell, because when they come to one of our analytic games and our games for senior level decision making, because they had that experience when they were going through PME, they tend to be better war gamers. But one thing that we can't get out of, and I'm sure Kevin has a similar story, these are all type A people and they want to win. And in our games, it's not important if they win, it's whether or not they test concepts, that they look at future force construct, but they want to win, and it's so freaking annoying. I'm sure, Kevin, you've seen that too.
Yeah, so we've experienced that, I would say, in probably the majority of our war games. However, we have... we've mitigated it. I want to say we've gotten rid of it. So we've introduced a second step, which is usually what we'll do now is, because we always want to do the analytical course of action and without any of the competitiveness, we'll have the students still fight a war game, but we'll take their COA on day one and then run it in a simulation in the background, completely separate from what they're doing in the classroom, and then just feed the results. So they get the educational part, and then they also get the thinking opponent competitive part. And we found that that kind of works for the most part, because then they're not questioning the results of whatever they're getting back, because they're not disagreeing with something that may have happened that they watched and so on.
And general officers are the worst. And, you know, what did you say the other time about colonels? You know, another name for that, it's asshole. Oops, sorry, I got your knee rating, man. You know, every colonel thinks he's way smarter than he actually or she actually is. I'm not saying how I know that, but these are type A people, and to get them into the game, and you know, you have different types, and from watching some of the games that they do over in education, you're trying to validate whether or not they understand the material. With us, there's a lot of times that they're experts in their fields. Take, for instance, hypersonics. Do you know who's not an expert in hypersonics? This guy. So it's trying to, yeah, okay, I got you. And this is in game development, and hoping that we got it right, because I have to explain games to them, and that I can do. Them trying to explain hypersonics to me, well, I can get you a guy for the next show you want to have who's the hypersonic guy, and he's an avid war gamer, and he's like, so you get that? And I go, yeah, I got most of it. So
it's I you know, individually I recognize all of those words as part of the English language, but in the sequence in which you've used it, I have no idea what you said.
Yeah, it's like, if it's something I know, then fine, I could teach you it. But no, there's certain things I don't. And especially when, you know, when we pull people in for our games, and like we just had one a couple of weeks ago, we were testing a new concept, Amphibious Doctrine. And they're like, you know, one of the folks asked me a question, and, you know, I'm just there for top cover. And the guy's asking me a question about two different types of amphibious ships. And I'm like, sounds good to me. And yeah. And he's like, well, who told you that was a good idea? That guy did. He goes, he doesn't know what he's talking about. And I'm like, I tried telling him that. I was trying to be nice. But you don't have to worry about that in a historical war game.
So you bringing up the distinction between what Kevin's doing in terms of using war games as sort of a Kevin, I'm paraphrasing what Mitch was throwing out there. So if I'm way off base, correct me, but kind of as a teaching tool, sort of as the test almost at the end of the course, like, did you learn this and can you apply it, is a different use of wargaming than what Mitch is describing in terms of analytical wargaming, which is much more generating ideas and concepts for generating data almost for future examination, which is different than course of action comparison, which is different than, you know, sort of the pretest building interest in the material material for folks, which is, you know, that when folks talk about professional wargaming, I think we've all run into this at some point in the professional wargaming career. You say the word wargame and somebody's thinking analytical, somebody else is thinking course of action analysis, somebody else is thinking a training tool. And because the word wargame sort of hugs all of those things, sometimes you got to be a little more particular about what it is you're describing. Kevin, has that been your experience?
Yeah, for the most part. And, you know, for the near peer simulations course that I've been running, because it's geared towards like just a broad exposure for people who may not even know what wargaming is, that's actually how we define it in the course, is it's just a system or a way of doing things, whether it's a rule set on a piece of paper or something verbal that you've agreed upon, instead of like an actual tangible product that they could put their hands on.
Yeah. And, you know, so at Connections US a couple of years ago, I gave I led a panel about wargaming literacy. And Brant, you kind of bring up the biggest problem we have that, you know, in 2014, DepSecDef Work wrote the DoD needs to wargame more. And it was right around the time they pulled the definition of wargaming out of the joint pub.
Yeah.
So the only definitions in JP5 is COA wargaming, which I did for a lot of my career. And it, even general officers, sometimes when they say wargaming, they use it as a verb and they don't understand it. It, you know, it's a form of analysis, either for educational or for senior level decision making. And they think modeling and simulations is just another war game. And I was trying to explain to somebody on the phone the other day that no. If we're going to combine the next war game with a lot of M&S tools, so you have qualitative and quantitative in one report that we write for you. And the guy's like, I just thought we'd play a game. And well, yeah.
Yeah, we went through a couple of years ago at one of the Connections Online, and we're cataloging the different kinds of war games that not in a formal sense, but just trying to give the audience, hey, when you think of wargaming, there's all these different kinds. My favorite one was the performative wargame. It's the wargame you do just so that people can say, yes, we did a wargame, and otherwise it really serves no other purpose.
Oh, is somebody talking about Naval War College? Oh, hey, we need to take that out. No, and it's funny. Like, there was a congressional study done on wargaming, and there's a GAO report on wargaming.
Yep.
Folks that are listening can download, I know, the GAO report. And, you know, Matt Caffrey asked me, hey, I want a list of all the wargamers in DOD. And my old office used to run the DWAG, the Defense Wargaming Alignment Group. And I said, well, dude, it's 350 people on the email list. And it's, you know how many offices have either wargaming in their title or within one of their major roles? And he's like, well, not that many. I go, no, dozens. And some of them don't even war game.
Yeah. And that's the official ones. That's not the unofficial ones that do it, even though it's not necessarily a part of their title or their official description.
Yeah. But like I tell people, you know, if you're, especially if you're in the military, you may never run or conduct a war game, but you can be in one at some time. You should know what you're doing.
As we, you know, looking at kind of that overlap between the hobby and the professional space, some of the games that hobbyists might recognize that you've either put on the table or on the screen in front of folks in that professional capacity. Mitch, you'd already mentioned getting out Third World War as one of the games that you're going to be throwing on the table just to familiarize folks with wargaming. What's another one or two or three that you've thrown out there? And what was kind of the reaction from the audience?
So I'll tell you what, I'm going to give you a hot tip for your audience. There is a commercial war game that's out there now that was developed actually for the military. And, you know, Sebastian Bay's Littoral Commander.
Yeah.
I'm helping him on number two, which takes place in the Baltics. But, you know, it's funny when I threw that out at work because we wanted to use it as a model for a game that we have to run in a couple of months. And, you know, this game's really good. And I don't know if you've played it. I'm pretty sure you have, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I know Kevin has because they have 11 copies in his office. And you know, but the interesting thing is, you know, you talk about throwing out a game like that. What I found is more interesting is go to Board Game Geek and look at the questions Sebastian gets about that game. And from that, you could see the difference in how professionals look at a game and what they need out of it as opposed to the hobbyist. But a lot of games that I've thrown out that, so I was used to be a war gamer for the Air Force, and I brought in a miniatures game called Blood Red Skies.
Okay.
And yep. a bunch of us sat down, and in order to sit down at the table, you have to be a patch. Folks out there should know what that is. They can look it up. And here are two graduated fighter wing commanders, and they're saying, this game abstracts in 2D. Imelmans, split S's, like, and the planes play like they should. This is pretty good. It's too bad it looks like a kid's game with dice.
Yeah.
And that's some of the pushback that I've gotten. The other one is somebody goes, recommend a game that's an amazing war game I could play with maybe my family. And I tell them to go play Root. And I don't know if you guys have played.
In the petting zoo.
You're sadistic.
Well, first of all, it's an amazing game. And they use it at the School of Advanced Military Studies.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of interesting, you know, what we put in front of people and what they think of it, as opposed to what's a really good game out there. And you know what a great game is? Anyone you love playing.
Yeah. Yeah. Kevin, for you, some of the civilian stuff that you've put in front of some of your military audience, what are some of the ones that you've used, digital or tabletop?
Just like Mitch, I've put Littoral Commander in front of people before on the tabletop side, just because it's pretty easy to learn. You could teach people how to play it.
Yeah.
That kind of signature footprint. And then for the digital side, really, it's just Flashpoint Campaigns and Command Modern Operations. Those are probably the two that people are going to be most familiar with. But for our Fight Club stuff we do on the side at MCU, we might play Strategic Command or War Plan, which are some pretty good grand strategy games for the digital side.
And I think Flashpoint you have to play in order to have a peaceful work environment. His boss, one of his favorite games.
Yeah.
And well, it's a great game.
The Flashpoint devs are a part of the actual dev team themselves are a part of our Origins crew that helps run the Wargame HQ at Origins. And so when we do our command post exercises at Origins for the audience to come participate in, we have the actual dev team are our pucksters. They're the guys running the machines for us. Because the way we set that one up, it's you guys would instantly recognize it as the equivalent of a Janus exercise or something similar within, you know, from a military context, where we bring the players in, assign them all roles within a military staff, and they're all playing as one team together. They develop the plan. We put the plan into Flashpoint Campaigns. Snyder hits go. And on turn one, when their entire plan goes to shit, we look at the commander and we go, all right, boss, now what? And we let them adjust as the battle unfolds, which is exactly what you would do in a normal command post exercise. But it's sort of cheating a little bit using Flashpoint Campaigns, because, again, we literally have the dev team. You know, it's Snyder and Crandall and Jeff Sugden and those guys are the ones that are running the machines for us. So it is cheating a little bit, but it makes for a very smooth event.
Yeah, I met those guys at the Connections USA, and it's a pretty sound game. It's also a lot of fun. So we'll give a shameless plug for those guys, I guess. But, you know, it's like I said, going back to running that at Origins, and I heard that you guys do that. Doesn't Merle run a game at Origins too?
Merle does the NSDM stuff. They're over in a different part of the building. They're not part of our Wargame HQ.
It's just kind of interesting. Like, it's so I ran a Team Yankee tournament a couple of years ago, which is not a fun game, unless you like tank porn. And, you know, a lot of the players that I noticed that were struggling with it served maybe 2 years in the army, were stationed in Germany during the 80s, and they just weren't getting it. I go, because you were not trained to play this game. You were trained in combined arms warfare. And the guy's like, I was a mechanic. And I'm like, they're not transferable skills. And the other way around, and I you guys may see this on social media, they're always looking for that most realistic war game. And I said, if one was ever created that you can buy, you'd hate it. And you know, Kevin and I both know OWS really well, and there was a guy during COVID when I did an article on it, and he's like, no, I really want to play that game. I think I'm going to be really good at it. I said, well, if you're in the DC area, I will meet you somewhere. We'll play it. And not saying I have a copy because it's not commercially available. And before the end of the first turn, he's like, yeah, I had enough. And he's like, I don't know if it's realistic or not, but it's really hard. And I go, well, you know, war's hard.
Yeah.
And to watch them do it. And then Sebastian and I actually brought an OWS map to a Historicon and watching the players, like, how many people do you need to play this game? And I'm like, I've seen it played with up to 60. And it was five guys per side, you know, like one domain commander and an overall command. And they were struggling with it. And they were like, but this is not fun. And I go, it was not created for that.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's the other one too. Like, we're going to play Chadwick's Third World War. It's not an easy game,
nope,
but he abstracts so many great things in that game. It's good enough. But then you kick it up a notch, and Kevin and I both know OWS. OWS is hard. And I know, Brant, you have some fam with it, right? You've seen it.
I've seen OWS. I've not played it. I want to get the opportunity to. I'm not in DC often enough that I can just pop into one of the random events you guys are doing. But I keep trying to lean on somebody to bring it to Origins one year.
You know, you can have somebody run it on Vassal.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's true.
You're digitizing it.
Vassal and I don't get along with each other. If you got a tabletop simulator version, I might could work with TTS, but
no,
Vassal and I are not friends.
No, Vassal sucks. And you know, they are developing a digital version of it.
Oh, wow.
That I've been playing around with, and I'm like, this game is just as hard.
Yeah.
Where
I'm making our capstone exercise in it.
Oh, and yeah, that's right, because we had a call with those guys the other day, and you know, it's really kind of hard, but you know, for us, and maybe Kevin will probably say something different, our games are not fun. We try to make them fun, but they're purposely not fun. And it's because we have a data collection management plan that we have to adhere to. And these are the things we have to see. And we have to see you make decisions, good and bad. And I always get asked, and I know Kevin does too, probably because he sees more human beings, different human beings than I do, is, hey, tell me a game where I could get this experience, like from a professional game, and I could play a hobby game. And I'm like, you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
You'll drive yourself crazy.
Yeah, I have a lot of people that ask me, like, oh, what's, you know, some niche wargaming software product that's not really known by the public. And it's like, I could point you to them, but I've probably refunded about four of them and hate the rest. Like he was saying, the super realistic war games are usually just they're not built for entertainment. They're built for purpose. That's the best way to put it.
Yeah. Well, ultimately, like, fun is a way to increase engagement. So if it's an optional exercise, like the things you do with Fight Club, where the idea is to maintain engagement and give people the opportunity to continue to iterate on that decision-making and practice those thought muscles, if you will, you want something fun because you want to maintain that engagement. Fun may in fact get in the way of some of the other things, probably a lot of the stuff you're doing, Mitch, that fun is almost a detriment to it. And you can get away with that in a professional context, because as some people have pointed out over the years, you can always find someone to be ordered to play. You know, it's in the hobby world, they kind of have to be fun or you lose your audience in a hurry and people walk away from it.
So you've never seen anybody play Campaign for North Africa in real life, have you?
I've seen people try to do it more. This goes back to the whole idea of the performative war game, right? It's not that they were doing it for fun. They were doing it because they wanted people to see them doing it.
Yeah. So these guys, I love naval games, which is really odd. And these guys talked me into playing Seekrieg one night. I don't know if you've ever played that. And yeah. So they are like, hey, you know, it was at a Historicon. We're starting at 8. Well, that's great because I have a game to play at 10. He goes, no, we play all night. And it must have been 12:30 at night. And I was on the U.S. side. It was midway. We still couldn't find each other. And I turned around to the guys that talked me into it. I go, I would sooner want to spend time in the Japanese POW camp than play this game. Oh, but it's super fun. It's super realistic. I go, yeah, it's taking about as long as the actual battle did. And, you know, gamers have to find their fun. And one thing I hate about, especially online, when somebody says that game sucks, and I'm like, you don't know what they're into. and I always used to say something, every song on every album ever put out, that song is somebody's favorite song, but that song sucks, but it's their favorite. And you have to kind of respect that. Curious question I almost have for Kevin, and I know I asked Matt this, and he said he's going to get back to me later, was, you know, I kind of wonder if there's ever a game that, a hobby game that was put in front of students, and they absolutely freaking hated it, because I can see that happening just as much.
If you want to count most of the digital war games as hobby games, then yeah, but that's more so due to a lack of just familiarity with the software. We've done some things like, so this year, one of the military faculty members ran a wargaming elective to try to broaden the exposure even more. And they brought a bunch of different things like Sails of Glory, Wings of Glory, some miniature stuff, just to kind of give them a little taste of everything. And most of the people who took that, most of the people who took that elective ended up liking it. It just, once they got to the complexity of OWS and Command, then it started, it's kind of like 50-50 at that point. But that goes back to whether people are interested in wargaming further than just the basic level.
It's kind of funny, the joke that instructor played on his students. He had them play two games that have been abandoned by their developer.
They're fun, though. I mean they liked it.
Oh, I have Sails and Wings of Glory up here. I even got the big the big planes, and somebody's like, I really want to get into that. I go, well, do you like used?
Yeah.
No. Well,
because Ares isn't doing new stuff with it right now, so
no they yeah. Kind of, and it sucks, because I really like, I thought Wings of Glory was a lot of fun. I only played the Great War version. I thought it was a lot of fun, because, you know, you look at that game, and what does a game designer do that's great was that, and you guys have played it, I'm sure. That,
I've played Wings, not Sails.
So in Wings of Glory, every aircraft, based on their maneuverability, had a different activation card deck, where if you have a rotary wing aircraft, that turn to the right was pretty good. You can hook right around. And it was such a good game that I don't know if they knew what they were on to. And, you know, games like that, where you're actually doing very hard things, but it's abstracted so well. And to watch, you know, students or military folks start to read between the tea leaves of what's actually going on in the game, between what they know, that is, to me, a little bit of magic. And it's great when that happens.
Yeah. Crimson Skies had a similar activation mechanic years ago as well.
The 12th season of Mentions and Dispatches is made possible by all of our Patreon supporters who pledged at the top level. The Armchair Dragoons would like to thank Michael Sunborg, Fred and his dog, Chet Bell, Hellcat 6, Patrick Geraghty, Stagger Wing, Kevin Bertram, Mike Quigley, Martok, and Joseph Knoll for their support of the Regiment of Strategy Gaming, which helps us bring you the best strategy gaming articles, events, and this podcast. You can join us as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
You mentioned the whole idea of, you know, isn't this fun? This is so realistic. Realism and fun are not synonymous with each other. Like we live in reality, and everybody complains about how much reality sucks. Why do you want the realistic version of something? You know, I mean, let's abstract out all the shitty stuff and just keep the fun, you know?
But like, I think, cause Kevin doesn't have a big social media footprint, or at least if he has it, I know he's on LinkedIn. He's prolific. I would recommend following Kevin on LinkedIn. Sorry, Kevin, you're going to get a lot more followers because he actually posts some really interesting stuff. But, you know, you see that it's always the gamers are fighting about that. And there was one, I think, during COVID, Risk is not a real war game. Well, yeah, it is.
Risk now, is the ultimate war game. It abstracts out literally everything but beating each other up.
Yeah. And, you know, it's that kind of...
it's a shitty war game, but it's...
But for you and I, it is. And for Kevin, it is. But like, for
someone's favorite song.
It's someone's favorite song somewhere. And absolutely. Like Axis and Allies. I played it. It wasn't my jam, but is that a war game? Yeah. And then, you know, with all the what makes a good war game, I'm like, anyone you like, if that's your favorite song, dance to it. But it's that difference between realism and what is good, abstracted, and having fun. I would say, do you really want realism or do you want challenging?
Yeah.
Because there's plenty of great games that are hard as crap to play. And some of them, like I'm pointing at Tarawa 43, the solo game. Have you guys played that?
I've seen it. I've not played that.
I have not.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you something. I can't win in that game. And I keep coming back, and people are like, well, once you win it, are you going to stop? No, because I want to win it as much as I've lost it. But I did a review of it. I saw somebody goes, yeah, it's a beer and pretzels, not a real war game. And I'm like, I think Tara was a real battle. I'm not 100% sure. but it's fun. I had a great time playing it. And it's a good little solo war game. So it's a lot of it's a bad experience. I really kind of wish, like, you know, a lot of gamers kind of understood that it's a hobby for fun. And, you know, sometimes I don't know if they hear themselves. And Brant, you and I are in some of the same Facebook groups. And some of the conversation is pretty ridiculous. And, well, I play a lot of war games, so therefore I understand strategy. And I'm like, playing war games in my job is a benefit. 30 years of understanding joint warfare is really what helps me out every day.
Yeah.
And like you guys make it sound so easy. My favorite was, and I think you're on that one, hey, I know how to win the war on Ukraine. Send the B-2 over Moscow because it's invisible, you know. And, you know, take out their leadership and the war would be over. And all right, so maybe I shouldn't tell people I do this, but if somebody says something like that, I will do a screen grab. And in one of my briefings, I will call it news from the front and I'll put it. And I put it up there, and I've been accused many times of, no, I know that you made that up. And I'm like, no, this is, you know, no shit, guys. There I was. No, these are actual people.
Get blocked by half the Facebook wargaming population just to prevent you from screen grabbing them.
Yeah, I guess they could. But, you know, it's that I think as long as hobby gamers keep demanding for new and interesting games that have innovative mechanics that we all benefit. And if Kevin can use it to run home a lesson with a bunch of students, or I can steal from it to kind of test out a concept or a weapon system or a future force construct, we're all better for it. And then, you know, leading into connections, that's the beauty of it, because getting the designers there into connections, they see things I don't. And it's like that thing from Men in Black, the first one, when he washes everybody out. He goes, thank you, gentlemen. You're definitely the product of years of military training and government training. And I think that's the beauty of it, is that the games don't need to be realistic, but they got to be good, interesting stuff that people want to play. And then, you know, when a game is brilliant, a game is brilliant. Like, have you guys played Rex Brennan's Nineveh yet?
Yeah.
Yes.
And I kid Rex a lot.
There's video of me and Peter Robbins screwing it up out there on the internet, actually.
Yeah, I know there is. But when you want to look for a game that has deep decision-making, realistic decision-making, and portrays urban combat how it should be portrayed, I think I called it, the article was Nineveh and the Genius of Game Design.
Yeah,
because it's a genius game. But these are the comments I heard. The game has cards and blocks. It's not a real war game.
Yeah.
And well, I go, well, that person's an expert.
And from a pair of first time game designers too. Rex and Brian are on there as co-designers, you know, helping polish it up for commercial palatability. But the underlying design was a pair of Rex's students. I mean, these were first-time designers that have no history with the wargaming world, which is fabulous to see somebody come out with something that good, you know, that early in their career.
Yeah, it's an amazing game, but you look at like how people rip that up.
Yeah.
Well, it's fine. It's cards and blocks. It can't be a real war game. I'm like, okay. I mean, and we're not going to discuss conflict and the three conflict games and war games here, are we?
No.
No. Good. Good. People seem to get upset about that.
No. But, we've only got another 20 minutes or so left in this podcast. It would take us 20 hours to go through all of that.
Yeah. I mean, I tell you what, we'll do it on my podcast. Less people listen. So, one of the things that I do get asked, and actually somebody who I met at Adepticon, I was on the phone with today, he's interested in becoming like what Kevin and I do. And I said, do you care about your mental health? But, you know, there's a lot of ways, I think, to get into it. And I think that's why I think Kevin's story is so interesting, because he's really good at it and he probably didn't think so.
Yeah.
Maybe it's my hubris.
I was going to get cut in my probationary period, to be honest. I thought it was going to be way above my head. And then it was like things that I had already been doing, they were just worded a different way. I just needed to learn the new language, but everything else was basically one-to-one.
Right. And I think his story and having, you know, because I think one of the first times you and I met face-to-face, you kind of told me about a lot of that. And I'm like, that's a way to do it. There is no magic. This is what I need to do. But a big thing is, you know how to analyze, understand what a game is, what it does, understand it's a form of manipulation, because that's what it is.
Yeah.
And you know, looking at the jobs, I think Kevin and I are both on the Georgetown University Wargaming Society, and we constantly post jobs there.
Yeah.
Because that's how you get into it. And I was telling one of my teammates today that we have to expand where I am, and I want to get younger and more diverse. And they said, well, why is that? And I'm like, because I don't know if I'm wrong, because 20 years or 30 years of thinking a certain way in wargaming, it's so creative that we need that diversity of thought. And why younger, they go, because I don't want to be doing this 10 years from now. I want to retire again.
Yeah.
and
somebody else to do it for the next 20 years.
Yeah. And I know at Connections in person, they do hiring. Where they look at resumes. I don't know if Connections Online does it, but I'm pretty sure that
we help folks get connected with some folks, but we don't have like the speed dating hiring intro kind of stuff. We just, given the nature of the way we're set up, that would be really hard to do in any sort of reasonably structured fashion.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, can we use you, Brant, as a conduit? If anybody if anybody there's listening and interested in this, look, you're free to give out my email address, my home one, and I'll look at your resume and tell you what's going on. The thing that sucks is a lot of the jobs are in the DC area.
Yep.
So there you go. But like anybody out there that's interested in it,
yeah,
reach out to somebody that you know. And obviously, if you're a listener here, you know Brant real well. We're always looking for talent. I know that you guys are growing over there too, and we need to get that pipeline. And we also need a better way of getting folks into that pipeline, because government hiring sucks.
Yeah, there were some folks on Quantico about 12, 13 years ago that were bugging me to come up there and take a job, probably very similar to where you are, Mitch. And I kept telling them, I don't want to live in DC. And the retort that I would get from them is, we're not in DC, we're in Quantico. Time out, guys. Just stop. Just stop with the charade, right? You've got DC traffic, DC TV, DC sports, DC headaches. Everything about you is DC except your zip code.
So in other words, you cannot become a Washington Capitals fan. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Among many other things, correct.
All right. Okay. I know. Yeah. It's the commute. Look, I grew up in New York City. If you can't tell, there's not that many people here. I shared my high school gym locker with 700 people, but you know, there's other places too. And, you know, there's academia type jobs.
Yep.
There's actually more a need for people to go into professional war game than one would think. But what we have to get rid of, I think, is the buddy bro network. And then I am actually self-loathing here. It's the recent military retiree job program.
Yep.
Because I could hang out with 10 buddies I served with and we all think the same way. That's not good, especially for something so creative. But somebody that has a different background, different way of thinking, even somebody right out of school, look, give it a shot. What's the worst that can happen? You go work for Google for $250,000 a year?
Yeah. Well, just the generational differences would impact some of those things. So
Nobody gets my jokes at work. I quote movies that, dude, I don't realize these lines are 30 years old. I walked into an office and I said, Joel, get off the babysitter. And nobody knew what I was talking about.
Yeah.
And I was really upset.
I frequently find that many of my, I expected it when I was teaching. teaching college, right? Yeah. I was expecting like the 18-year-olds are not going to get Animal House references. And on one level, that sort of wounds me. But on another level, like that movie's 40 years old and came out when their parents were kids. So I kind of get it from that perspective. But there's, you know, when I'm dealing with fellow professionals on a conference call, and look, I work in IT, right? We're not exactly lacking in high nerdery around my teams or anything. And folks aren't getting the Star Trek references. And not the obscure Star Trek references. You make a Kobayashi Maru reference and people didn't get it. It's like, you're killing me, guys. Kevin, I want to go back to some of the stuff you've got with your students in the classroom and kind of the experiences and reactions that folks have to the wargaming that you've got there, because I'm suspecting, in spite of Secretary Work's memo that's now 10 years in the rearview mirror, the institutionalization of wargaming in professional military education has not happened near as much nor as quickly as most of us would have really liked. So I got to believe that there's going to be some folks that you're having in some of your classes or some of, not necessarily your classes, but the war games that you're running as a part of the classes, that don't have a lot of exposure to wargaming, and kind of how that's received by those players, how they're reacting to it. And if there's much of a difference, a discernible difference in their reaction from something purpose built for the military versus a hobby, something you've adapted to their usage. I know I just threw a bunch of stuff at you. Grab that and run with it however you want.
Sure. So I guess I should just preface everything I'm about to say with, it's all due to growing pains, I believe. Really, honestly, the reactions is a mixed bag. You'll get people, and I'm going to name drop him because he's a fantastic logistician, but Major Matthew Evers at MCU, he's an amazing war gamer. You'll get people like him who are just really into it and they dig it, and they will actually pull their, you know, planning teams through the exercise and help them along. And then you'll get the complete opposite, you know, where I've been told verbatim by a student, I was volunteered to be the operator. You know, I don't even touch a computer unless I look at emails. I don't know what I'm doing here. And the schools are always working on such a fine timeline where we might only have 3 days for the war game and then 2 days to train somebody up on one of the most complex systems. So a lot of these things are, I believe, we have people who are in place of adding this new capability the Marine Corps has invested into the curriculum, without the Marine Corps actually investing into the kind of education they need to understand, okay, what is wargaming? How do I set one up? What kinds of things are going to be smooth and not smooth? So it's just the military at the end of the day putting, you know, the cart before the horse, where we've got this capability and we want everybody to use it, but there's only a very few amount of people who know how to use it. And those people end up rotating out when they go on to their next duty station anyways. So it's kind of a mixed bag, but I think as time goes on, they'll be able to refine that process and start training the MILFACs up every year.
And Matt Evers is such a bad example. That guy was an addicted war gamer that just happened to go to Annapolis and join the Marine Corps. New Year's Day a couple of years ago, he, myself, and two other people played Fire in the Lake the entire from 65 till we had a winner. Oh, and geez. Let me tell you, yeah, 12 hours later, but we had a blast. But that cat's a junkie diehard war gamer. And I've seen him like at Fight Club when we had it in D.C. Watching him take apart a game, I think, is interesting. His big downfall is he loves the game John Company, which I'll never play with him again. No offense,
yeah, he's
Cole.
Great.
You lost that bad, huh?
Well, it's one of those things where I was the only one that wasn't into it. And like, you know, my wingman Sebastian's like, I got to get out of here. And I'm like, oh, geez, I have to stay until we make all of India British. Oh, good God. You know, it's Matt's favorite song. It's not my cup of tea, but I tried it. And but he's a great example. I wish there were more like him. And it's so important that we get him to, you know, when he goes off to command, you know, wargaming is a great team building thing that you can do. That's why we do it on Fridays. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of work, but, you know, guys like that is what makes it worthwhile. I hope he doesn't listen to this because I got to see him like, I think the Saturday after next, and he's going to be smiling at me and, with his Hawaiian shirt on. So, but
Kevin, you mentioned, some of the difficulties with getting folks into the wargaming mindset, especially on the digital side. When many moons ago, back when I was in grad school and I was doing some of the data collection and then some of the analysis for my dissertation that never quite got finished, one of the things I was looking at was the differences in levels of interactivity for how it would affect people learning. And so if you give them something that's much more interactive, like a game, how much better would they learn than if you give them something more static, like the Slide-O-Matic? Let's just put a bunch of static slides in front of them with the quiz at the end, and like, who's actually going to retain the material better? And the thing that we found that was actually the greatest contributor to the variance in whether or not people learned the material, it wasn't just a level of interactivity. It was the folks that had some significant game experience, not because of the games themselves, but because they picked up the user interface for the game so much faster that they were then able to focus on the lesson that was being presented in the game, rather than having to fight the interface and learn all the buttonology and the key combinations and everything. They could just, the WASD movement controls with the left hand, that was already second nature to those folks. And they could just focus on what was being presented to them in the game instead of worrying about how to actually control people moving around or whatever else was going on in the game. And so that kind of resonates a little bit when you talk about having to teach people just how to use the damn game, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, war games for manipulation, to watch those gears turn to me is amazing. And that experiential learning with war games, especially ones that, you know, we often have to play because we can't do one-on-one games that much. And I think this is true for Kevin as well. They have to go off to the side in their little teams and plan. And I cannot tell you how much you can get and understand about your players understanding a concept or a lesson plan just from listening to that, no matter how well that COA works out for them. It doesn't make a difference. And I think Kevin made that point earlier. It's because I know what they're thinking and I know how their decision-making went. There's so much that you can take from that. And then looking at, you know, where Kevin is, they have a huge digital library. And I mentioned to somebody, like, you know, it would be great every time they played this game, what wins it the most efficiently? Data farming off of that.
Yeah.
And using that to help reinforce lessons. It's a beauty of it. And it's why I'm addicted. What was that?
I was going to say, you'll be excited. I'm working on a project.
Now. I know. I just remember, someone's going to call you up and say the Nuremberg protocols. You're not allowed to do it. I'm not kidding you.
I think you touched on something that goes into just wargaming in general, not to interrupt here, but I honestly think most of the problems with wargaming now that I've been at MCU, at least on the PME side for a couple years, is if people don't already have wargaming experience by the time they're a major, because we really only see it at the operational level on up. Captains at EWS love it. It's kind of like their vacation time. They're really into it. I think what it is it's hard to connect the dots as to like how this game applies to their branch specifically. So because they were never introduced as a second lieutenant, you know, who might be an infantry officer, hey, here's a war game that can help you on the platoon level. By the time they're an infantry officer at the major level, they don't really care about wargaming. They just care about planning at that level. And so when you try to introduce this game to them, 9 times out of 10, they just think it's a waste of time or it's just something nerdy to do because they just weren't experienced to how it can translate to their specific job.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? I'll tell a little anecdotal story. So I was asked to go up to an Army Futures War game up at Carlisle, and
you lost the bet, huh?
What was that?
You lost the bet, didn't you?
I had to go. I had to go to adjudicate air because, you know, how does an Army guy spell air? T-A-N-K.
Yes.
And the 4-star was there observing the game. He actually read the rules. And I adjudicated joint long-range fires. And he turned around to, I think, his deputy, and he goes, I've been in the Army for, like, way over 36. I don't remember what he said, because, and I've heard of joint fires, but now I actually know how it works because I just saw it. And that's from a war game. You're always learning, as Matt ever says, right? Always learning.
Well, you should be always learning.
Yeah.
So you mentioned earlier the Sebastian's littoral commander getting out in front of folks and being something recognizable that the guys can grab and play with. Back in 05, when I was still having delusions of grandeur of being a game publisher, I learned very early. Folks, longtime podcast listeners have heard this. I'm not a great business guy. Didn't enjoy the running the business side of things. Enjoyed the design stuff. Didn't enjoy running the business. Was not very good at it. Those two probably go hand in hand, which is why I don't run a publishing company anymore. But we had published the original Warfighter series, not the one Dan Versen stole the name and ran off with, but the original Warfighter series was you know, modern platoon level combat. I was a tank guy. You know, you like making fun of the tanks. That's what I did, right? You know, I was a 19 series guy. But the it was modern platoon level combat. You basically had a battalion TO&E that you were fighting through. And it was, to say it was, you know, Panzer Blitz updated to the modern era is a little simplistic, but a non-war gamer would recognize that comparison. But with me having been in the National Guard at the time, and soliciting some potential military audiences for this, that got some attention from some people. We had an article about it written in National Defense Magazine back in 05. It resulted in exactly zero additional sales of the game, which was unfortunate. The biggest challenge we had, two things. One, the Army was not ready for that kind of wargaming at that point in time. But two, nobody cared about kinetic combat in 2005.
Right? Nope.
I mean, they were all worried about counterinsurgency stuff in Iraq and Afghanistan, which I get. Like that was the very immediate real world concern in front of them. And you know, kinetic combat and battalion level, you know, high intensity ops was not something people cared about. But you know, did take a swing at it, and unfortunately just didn't have the right audience at the right time in their careers to really, you know, attract much attention, which was unfortunate. It would have been kind of cool. You know, because I see all the attention that Littoral Commander is getting, and it's not a jealousy that game's successful and mine wasn't. It's more of a jealousy of he's got the right environment to push this thing out and have people pay attention. And, mm-hmm. and that would have been really cool to have, you know, almost 20 years ago at this point. So,
well, look, I mean, I think the three of us can probably put out a real shitty war game ourselves. you know, it's, I think he hit the right environment. And, you know, look, let's be honest, because hopefully he won't listen. He's pretty gifted at the design, and he has a lot of the students helping him out. And I'm like, you're not treating me like your students. And, you know, he's a little tyrannical, but it really works for him. But like, you know, it's kind of like everybody can draw on a piece of paper. A few people are artists. Yeah. And it, sometimes that's it. But I think the time now, we're looking for artists. And, you know, it's sad because you're right. We were totally focused on counterinsurgency for all those years. Somebody asked me the other day, what's the most interesting thing you've seen in the last 3 years of the evolution of military combat? And I said, you're not going to believe it. And they go, what's that? I go, trench warfare's back.
Yeah.
And when was the last time that we looked at that or wargamed it? It's Gulf sometimes one. It's just timing, huh?
Gulf one, because we were expecting to have to break through a pretty extensive trench network as a part of the invasion to kick the Iraqis out of Kuwait. But even then, it wasn't static trench warfare of both sides in trenches. It was how to break through one.
It's going on right now as we speak in Europe. And it's kind of freaky. Like, you know, so are we going to see a ton of games that deal with it? I know there's a Ukraine game coming out from GMT, and a lot of people saw it too soon. Maybe so, but like, you know, what good ideas from former, I love anything Great War. And I started looking at games that deal with trench warfare because we may get asked to do that someday at work.
A Ukraine design on the drawing board. I was actually taking pre-orders on again back when I had delusions of being a game publisher back in 2007 and was actually written about in 2014. And Brian Train and I grabbed another Dragoon or two and did a podcast not long after the Ukraine war broke out a couple years ago, because Brian had also designed a Ukraine game. And we were talking about sort of all the things we got wrong. And we easily filled an hour podcast on that. Essentially, Brian got several of the domains of operation reasonably correct, but some of the underlying motivations and approaches he was a little off base on. I actually had a lot of the backstory in terms of sort of the disputed election and the separatist movements in the East. I had a lot of that stuff correct and literally everything else wrong. I was looking at a very mobile, fluid maneuver warfare type of front, which is absolutely not at all what had happened. And not long after that war broke out, somebody had reached out to me and said, "Hey, are you going to go back and update this thing?" And I was like, no, it is so far out of date. the orders of battle are 18 years old at this point, and the types of warfare that have actually unfolded are so dramatically different than what I built that game around. There's no way. You'd have to just chuck the whole thing and start over, which is not a bad thing. I mean, it if I could predict that kind of stuff, I'd be picking lottery numbers.
I was just about to ask you, if you can predict the future, would you do it to write a game? No, it would be definitely lottery. Now games are going to be coming out. Mark Walker's Donetsk in Yeah Magazine. Actually not a bad game, but he did it afterwards. The other one, too, is... Did you guys notice when the war broke out? It was the same people that were experts on virology during COVID. We're all of a sudden military experts. Yeah, and, yeah. The tank is dead and like making all these things. And, the news wasn't telling everything, especially if you have other sources of information.
Yes.
And it's just interesting, the food fights that people were having. And somebody asked me, "What do you think of this?" And I go, "Well, they're both wrong. I could agree with them, but then we'd all be wrong." Yeah. And that's the thing about, warfare does evolve. And one thing I love about the hobby community is that they're also evolving designs to capture all that. And even of old battles, I'm pointing at it now, but A Most Fearful Sacrifice, it took 180 years after the battle to have a great game that actually plays the C2 problems of that battle right. But how many times did Herman look at, C2 problems in history that are going on today and said, I think I could gamify that. And I think that's the beauty of that game. Sorry, shameless plug, Herman.
I'm sure Herman will forgive you.
Yeah. So. Yeah. He's all right. He's good. He's a good guy. So, but yeah. It's fun stuff.
So as we start to wind this down, cause we're a little over an hour as we're recording this, I'm sure by the time we edit out me saying, we'll get it down a bit, but as we start to wrap this up, if there's a particular thought or lesson or idea from your experiences with the intersection of hobby and professional wargaming, Kevin, is there some particular thought that you would want the audience to really make sure that they kind of grab and run with and think about for where that overlap is in the Venn diagram?
Yeah, I think the one piece of advice I would give people, whether they're like a civilian that has no wargaming experience, practitioner, or even like a military professional, is I wouldn't care too much about what I'm using to teach. So what I like to remind myself is, do we care more about the methodology or the learning outcomes? And so if the learning outcomes requires that you use a game that is subpar in many systems, but it might do two or three things really well you need to look at, then to take those two or three things. Like, don't be afraid to think outside the box and create exactly what you need. I think a lot of people get too down in the weeds of Google searching the perfect war game to suit what they need. And there is no perfect war game. So just, choose a good one and modify it to suit your needs.
That was beautiful. My man. Hold on here. I'm a little broken up because what he said was great. I was going to say something like keep rolling sixes, but that's a lot of it too. It's something I actually told somebody the other time. As you're playing these games, always take a minute while you're having fun to realize what you're learning and what you're not. And I that's about it. Kevin is way wiser than I am. I've made a lot of bad decisions, and I'm sure he'll say that. But hopefully I'll see you next Friday, Third World War.
Yeah, text me. We'll talk about it, because I'll have to get out of work for that.
You're listening to folks arranging their war games in real time here on the on Mention.
Well, Brant, what are you playing next? And what's something you're dying to get to the table?
So I've got... it's in the bag over here. I'm not going to dig it out of the bottom of the bag. I've got Splendid Little War, the Cuba Splendid Little War from Victory Point Games that I've had for months now, and I can't get anybody to, I'm finally going to have to just solo this thing two-handed. I keep taking it to the war game days with me that we have here locally, and something else gets played every time, and I'm finally just going to have to get this thing out and solo it myself.
Wasn't that game repopped? Because I have that game.
I don't know if it was one of the ones that moved from Victory Point to Tabletop Tycoon when they bought out Victory Point Games. It's under the Victory Point banner where Tabletop Tycoon has like four different imprints underneath them because they've got the reprints of the States of Siege games of Ottoman Sunset, Habsburg Eclipse. That's when I got Cuba also. I got the States of Siege ones and I got that one.
Because I have the Ty Bomba one and then I have, well, Splendid Little War. I think it's by Revolution. But I know. Let me see. No, I don't have that.
Yeah, this one's from Victory Point by way of Tabletop Tycoon. So
So if I can tell the future, there is a game I'm going to get Kevin into in 2024. And
I'm listening.
Oh, I know what it is. So I'm going to try to hook him up with some bolt action stuff.
Oh boy. Okay, finally. Yeah.
So Warlord was expected to have a pretty significant presence at Origins this year, and we're trying to see if we can get the Origins management to get us like across the aisle from where they're going to be. And Jason Matthews is supposed to be helping pull together a pretty large Twilight Struggle tournament because of Twilight Struggle going into the Origins Hall of Fame this year. Jason's going to be there, Nana's going to be there. There's going to be a bunch of Twilight Struggle stuff going on. So we're trying to get this
overrated.
Like the Twilight Struggle tournament, our Wargame HQ, the Warlord guys doing all the bolt action stuff, all kind of right in one area.
Well, so. Warlord North America dude is a close friend. Actually, he crashes at my house during Connections when it's here. And I asked him to hook old Kevin up with a starter kit. So I have to see what he wants to play. And,
is that John?
Russell, my BFF.
Met him at Gamma Expo when we were talking about Origin stuff while we were there.
Yeah, he's awesome. Retired Air Force as well. And I just saw him over at Adepticon, which I got into a game that I'm most embarrassed to have on my shelf.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So
is it one of the 40Ks?
Oh no. I'm far too. I'm not joining a cult.
He's got self respect. Yeah.
I do. And okay, so this will go a couple minutes. I'm sorry, Brant. So I was helping them. I was working with the event staff there, and it was the Nerds of War guys out of Ohio. Awesome guys. You want to get them for Origins. They know how to run a con.
I think they're there anyway. I think they've got a whole block of mini stuff set up in the game hall.
Yeah, they're awesome guys. Mike Rafferty, I actually talked to him today. So everybody, you know, they all game together. And I'm new guy, right? They're like, you got to try this song of Ice and Fire. And I'm like, I thought it was like, you know, 16th century because I'm playing by fire and sword and this and that. And they're like, no. And I played the game and they didn't tell me that it's based on Game of Thrones and a book.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's actually an amazing ass game. And so I go and play in the beginner's tournament and they gave me a medal because I was the last one left. And I played two intermediate gamers, actually won both games. And the guy's like, how can you support, people in, people in the family date one another? But how can you support all that? And I go, what the hell are you talking about? Well, you play these guys. And I'm like, I liked it because of the midget. I have no idea. I've never seen the show. I know nothing about it. And they're making fun of me. And I'm like, I got to be honest with you. I didn't know it was a fantasy game till some guy played a giant against me and a dragon. But it's a tight little game. Yeah. And there's pictures out there of me playing it at Adepticon, and I don't want to ruin my historical wargaming creds, but it's an amazing game.
So you had to admit it here. The book series is called A Song of Ice and Fire. The TV series grabbed the Game of Thrones name to run with from the line in one of the books, but that's what the whole series of books is called, and so that's where that comes from. As we are recording this, folks listening 3 years from now will have missed it, but as we are recording this and as it's going live later this week for distribution, Gameland Games actually has on Kickstarter right now their latest in their Tiny Epic series of games is Tiny Epic Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
so where they've got Tiny Epic Galaxies, Tiny Epic Kingdoms, Tiny Epic Crimes, all those. The latest one is Tiny Epic Game of Thrones. It's the first licensed Tiny Epic series anything they've done, and it's on Kickstarter right now.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually saw two of the first three episodes when I had COVID right after a con, go figure. And somebody's like, oh, did you like this? What do you think of this character? I go, look, man, I couldn't get over all the nudity. Doesn't Emilia Clarke ever wear underwear?
Actually, once you get past the first season, yes, she's not naked for the rest of the show. So,
oh, well, she's made up for it in the first few episodes. Yes. So, yeah. But I'm glad to have admitted that here.
Rather than your own podcast.
Yeah, because I get hate mail of how stupid I am. And I'm like, look, dude, if I want to know how stupid I am, I'll go talk to my 17-year-old.
Guys, this has been fun. I appreciate y'all being here. Audience, I hope you had as much fun as we did. As we are starting to wind down season 12 of Mentioned and Dispatches, heading into the summer, we're going to shift back mostly to hobby stuff for the rest of the season. One other thing just to note out there, Mitch, I don't know if yours is one of the ones that shows up in the listings over on Board Game Geek, but the Golden Geek Award nominations are going on right now. Mentioned in Dispatches is in the podcast list. We have zero illusions of ever winning, but what would be really cool is if we could at least make the final vote. So if we can get folks to go, you know, throw us a nomination, we've got the links and the screen grabs and everything attached to this episode so you can see there where to go to make the vote. If you don't have enough geek gold for it, hit me up. I got a ton of geek gold laying around from all the pictures we've stuck on BGG over the years, because you need some geek gold to be able to vote. We just want to make the final day, right? We just want to make that final cut and then lose to something with Meeple in the title at that point.
I voted for you last year.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Sadly, because, it didn't matter.
Yeah, because, you know, look, any awards, no. Because in the end, you lose out to Euro Trash Gaming.
So, things with Meeple in the title, yes.
Yeah, you have to have Meeple in it. So, but, yeah. I've always been a fan.
But last year, Liz, Beyond Solitaire, did make the final cut.
She did.
She was in the final list of games. So we're hoping to kick Liz out and take her place this year. Sorry, Liz. but I'm shamelessly begging for votes. It is absolutely a pure popularity contest, and I'm hoping that I can scrounge enough votes to be cool enough to sit at the big kids table 1 year for Mentioned Dispatches. So
if you make one of your pleas shareable, I'll throw it on our Facebook stream.
Sure, we can definitely do that.
I think we did it for Liz 1 year, but you know, I'm not getting checks from her anymore.
Cool. Kevin, thank you for being here. Appreciate you taking the time, especially since you were like running classes earlier this evening. So
thanks for having me. Yeah.
I know you're up past your bedtime and we appreciate it. And Mitch, it's not hard to get you to show up when there's a microphone nearby. So
yeah. But Kevin is, and I mean this, way more interesting than I am.
Say that. You get to do all the secret stuff.
Nah, it's, you know, look, once you know where the alien bodies are buried, it's not all that much fun.
Even if he was having fun doing the secret stuff, he couldn't admit it here.
I have no idea. Look, you know, the fact that the government trusts me that much shows you a little bit about the government. misjudged. But we'll get you over sometime, Kevin.
Yeah, cool. Sure.
Audience, we hope you've had a good time with this. We appreciate you listening, and we'll catch you next time on another episode of Mentioned in Dispatches.